this center and the technology that you see here, although it won't get extensively used in this talk, represents state-of-the-art in terms of the supercomputing, the connectivity to the internet, the conjunction of multimedia, and all of its arrangements such that people can, for example, live stream presentations like this to other people around the world, do it interactively, and exchange a great amount of information through a wide range of visualization and interactivity tools. This is where I used to work, or work like this at Simon Fraser, so this is an old stomping ground of mine. My name is Loki Jorgensen. I've personally known Ajahn Brahm for 24 hours now. it's very personal. And so I'm very pleased to do this introduction. In that 24 hours, I've come to know a great number of things about him. Some are simply and purely factual, and those are the only ones I can really relate to. At the age of 16, discovering Buddhism through an extensive market analysis of the available religions, chose Buddhism for its value proposition. And subsequently, being at Cambridge and completing his degree in theoretical physics, where there's some concern, my background is in physics as well, then subsequently went to Thailand, became ordained as a monk in the Thai tradition, Theravadan tradition, at the age of 23, and then spent 9 years in Thailand. Subsequently went to Australia and was established the Hodiyana Monastery near Perth in Serpentine, which is just outside of Perth, and has done a great many other things. His transcriptions, his book, which he's currently promoting as part of this tour, and of course the kind of work that he's going to talk about, which is people, relationships, living, the things that I think Buddhism we recognize is well known for. So I would like to now turn this over to Ajahn Balabhas.
Thanks a lot. It's great to come back to university to give a talk. This afternoon's talk, I'm not just going to give the ordinary talks which I have been given the last few days. It's great to talk to the audience because there's many academics here. My own story of going through a university like Cambridge and being good enough in the sciences to not only get scholarships to Cambridge, but offered to carry on with postgrad work, but refused it. The reason I wanted to find out something more deeper about science. I'd never given up my search into science. Sometimes that I thought that some of the physics was not going in a wise enough direction. Maybe it was emphasized when I went to a seminar on religion and science in Australia some years ago. I was supposed to be presenting the religious aspect as a Buddhist monk, but I also presented some of the physics aspect of the seminar. And there was a very wonderful question which was asked after the seminar by a Catholic girl. What she said was, whenever I look into a telescope at the universe, I always feel my religion is threatened. Please comment on that. It was an honest question from a religious believer. I had to tell her that many physicists, if they look at the opposite end of the telescope, back into the small end, to see who's looking, then religion or science gets threatened in the same way. But I wanted to really spend a lot of my life looking at the other end of the telescope to find out who was watching this. What in my years was used to be called the ghost in the machine, exactly what this was. And also, I wanted to find out for myself, not accepting this from any authority, because the science which I learned was a very rebellious science. I always remember the statements of one of the founders of science, which was Sir Roger Bacon, who founded the Royal Society in London, who always proposed that science should progress on the method of disproof, realizing you cannot prove anything. You may do the experiment 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 times and it works, but it doesn't prove anything at all. But you do it once and it doesn't work, and then you've disproved it. Disproof is a much more powerful instrument to discover truth than a way of proof. So the science I learned was actually to propose something and do your damnedest to try to disprove it. And there, if you find an anomaly, something which doesn't work, then you're getting somewhere. And that was what I wanted to do in my Buddhist path, especially because the Buddhist path was actually training your mind and the powerful meditation techniques. These are the sorts of things I thought was a laboratory where you could find out something about the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness. So I know that Buddhism has proposed for the last 2,500 years that this thing which we call the mind is the sixth sense and transcends any of the five senses of the body. And of course I was fascinated to listen or to either to hear or read that in ancient Greek philosophy people like Aristotle did recognize six senses. The five senses, which we all know today of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, but he also recognized the sixth sense of mind, which he called the common sense, in the way that the mind can actually know what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch. And I often say, as a joke, but also as quite an acid comment, that one of the problems with our Western world is in the last 2,000 years, not only have we lost our common sense, but we've misplaced our mind as well. So it's great to be able to include that mind into things. And of course, being a meditator, you have a close understanding of what that mind is. But you have to be objective about this. And so for the last 20 years, 30 years, I have been collecting evidence about the nature of the mind. What really surprises me is that evidence is out there, it's solid, but very often people ignore it. One of the first pieces of evidence which really struck me was a fellow called Professor John Lorber of Sheffield University. About 20 years ago now, he was doing some preliminary work on the brain, and his specific area of expertise was to try and find out that people whose heads were slightly misshaped because some accident of birth, to see whether their misshaped skulls had any effect on their brain, their learning abilities, and their personality. So whenever he was going on the campus, if ever he saw a student whose head was slightly misshaped, he'd offer him a few pounds to join in his research project, which a student obviously readily agreed to. And one day he found this one student whose head was slightly misshaped. He joined the research program, and when he gave him the first CT scan, he found the boy had no brain. He was an honors student, a graduate in honors with honors in mathematics, and he only had 1% of cortex in his brain. The rest was intracranial fluid. Now I want you to do a little experiment. Can you please move your head from back to forward? Can you hear any sloshing? Because if you can, you are also filled with intracranial fluid and no brain. But the amazing thing was that that guy, he was highly intelligent, his IQ was something like 136 or something. Honor student in mathematics, he had a very stable social life. About the 1% of cortex which he remained could not explain his ability to function. That was the first of evidence that maybe you can have a mind without a brain. However, when I talked about that piece of research to a GP who was stressed out and was going to a retreat I was leading because he wanted to chill out a bit, he was telling me that he'd seen that CT scan, it'd been done many times, and he told me that you wouldn't believe the amount of angst that was causing to the medical world. That was threatening $1 billion of research, many careers, and also established science that the brain somehow generates a mind. The point is that one of the reasons which I left science is because I thought it was getting too dogmatic. There was a saying which was going around the labs at the time that the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field.
Sorry, that's a personal piece.
Yeah. In other words, sometimes it's nature. You've got to keep your research grants. You've got to keep your place in the university. That's your livelihood. But unfortunately, the system means that there's a lot of obstruction to new ideas, to new information. And so the path of science is sometimes hindered. The scientists I knew at Cambridge were all rebels. They were eccentric. And that was the best part of them. One of the most memorable experiences of my life at Cambridge was when the Astronomical Society, of which I was a member, was holding its, I think, 200th anniversary of its founding. And so they had a double lecture in the biggest lecture theatre of Cambridge, which was in a chemistry lab at the time. The B lecture was being, the taught speaker was the guy who invented quasars. Well, not invented, but discovered them, sorry. He actually was only the B lecturer, because the A lecturer was Sir Fred Hoyle. And many of you may know him. He's as mad as a coot, completely eccentric, but absolutely brilliant. I was very fortunate to actually misunderstand the timing. I got there an hour earlier, and I could only get a seat actually in the aisles, on the steps. All the chairs were taken. It was one of the biggest lectures in Cambridge of my generation. And there was not just physicists or mathematicians were there. Philosophers, people from the architecture department, everybody was there. Because this was one brilliant lecturer. Not only did he have an amazing mind, he could also present his ideas in an incredibly stimulating way. He later got thrown out of Cambridge. But that's what you call a great scientist. Someone who's willing to get thrown out. Because for them, the truth is more important than actually just getting on. And that rebelliousness was something which really motivated me in Buddhism. Because real religion is always rebellious. We'll always see things in a different way. We'll actually expand people's ideas rather than limit them. There are two types of religion you find in this world today. There is one which bends the facts to fit the faith. And I think many of you know those religions. And there is those which bends the faith to fit the facts. It doesn't matter anything in a religion, whether it's Buddhism, Christianity or whatever, or science. If the facts say, no, that's wrong, please change your faith. Change your faith to fit the facts. Because that's the only way of truth, of honesty. So when I started seeing these things about the nature of the mind being independent from the brain, I really got into this sort of stuff, because that was fascinating. Not only did it accord to my own experiences, because we do a type of meditation in Buddhism called the jhanas, and these are states of depth of meditation where amazing things happen. This is one true story of one of my disciples in Perth, Western Australia, who would only usually meditate for 40 minutes, 45 minutes max. On this one occasion, he was at home, meditating in his bedroom. After an hour and a half, he still hadn't come out, so his wife went to go and check on him. She saw him sitting there, cross-legged, very still. Too still, because she could not see him breathing. She got so scared, she called the ambulance, the emergency number in Perth at 000, and called an ambulance. The ambulance came screaming to the house, the medics came out, took his pulse, could find no pulse. He wasn't breathing. So they put him in the stretcher, in the back of the ambulance. And they rushing through every red light. They went at the top speed to the emergency room of Sir Charles Gardner Hospital where this happened, wheeled him into the emergency room, straight away put an ECG on his heart. It was a flat line. Ding, 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 cardiac arrest. They put the EEG on his brain. Another flat line. Ding, ding, ding,
brain dead. It was very fortunate that the doctor on duty that day in the emergency room was of Indian extraction. His parents had migrated from India. He'd grown up in Australia, but at least he'd heard his parents tell tales of yogis going into such deep meditation they can suspend all of their life activity. He heard from the man's wife that he'd been meditating, so he decided to give him a chance. Normally, they'd have just put him straight down into the morgue. And it was very fortunate he wasn't sent to the morgue, because when he came out of his meditation, he would have scared the pants off the people working in the morgue. He probably would have killed them. While in this deep state of meditation, the doctor put defibrillators on the chest, electric shocks to try to stimulate the heart back into action. You may have seen those in the movies or on the TV. They jerk the body a couple of centimeters off the bed. They're very violent. Many, many times this was done on this man, but nothing worked. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. At that point, the ECG and the EEG registered normal wave patterns. There was nothing wrong with him. The doctor gave him a checkup and he walked home. This is an amazing case, true, one of many, where people go into such a deep state of meditation that their brain is not working, neither is their heart, but he's fully alert. When you ask him what he was experiencing, incredible clarity of mind, but completely separated from any feelings in the body. Blissed out, but not with the body. If you don't believe stories like that, I will refer you to the December 2001 edition of Lancet, the journal of the British Medical Association, which does not publish New Age flaky science. But in this particular article, the leading author was Professor Pim van Lommel of the Netherlands. He wrote an article which he titled, Consciousness Survives the Death of the Brain. Because his particular research was generated by an early experience as a GP, or rather as an intern in one of the hospitals in Holland, where one of his patients, who clinically died on the table but was revived later, reported what is now called an NDE, near-death experience, in which he was floating out of his body, being able to hear the conversations of the doctors and nurses around, and also being able to see exactly what was happening. It was such an accurate recall of what was happening at a time when he should have been completely unconscious that the doctor was fascinated whether these things were true and why they happened. So later in his life, when he became a professor, a teacher at those hospitals, he decided to do some research on NDEs. Near-death experiences. It was very easy for him to establish that such NDEs happen. The recall of the conversations and the memory of the medical procedures involved when a person was under full anesthetic was so easily to corroborate as accurate. Near-death experiences were happening. What he wanted to find out was why. What he found out with much research over many hospitals was that the NDEs only happen, and they only happen in about 10% of cases, where the person is under cardiac arrest, where there's no brain activity at all, they're basically brain dead. He discounted any possibility for these moments of consciousness to be derived from the brain, because the brain was inoperative if it was flooded with neurotransmitters at the time of death, they should not have been able to give a coherent experience which you can remember and recall sometime later. Basically, his conclusion was that consciousness in the time of NDEs was completely independent of the brain. Now that's something which is a powerful part of religion and science, proving that the mind is bigger than your body or your brain. One of these days, someone is going to have a brain transplant. I'm waiting for that time, because if you transplant my brain, say with Loki's over there, we swap our brains. When I get his brain and you get mine, who will I be? Will I be Loki the monk? Will you be Brahm, the wife of Kara? Who will you be? And you will actually find that after a short while, that no matter what brain I have, I'll still be Brahm and you will still be Loki. Because the brain is not the generator of this thing we call the mind. We say this because, according to the Buddhist cosmology, your mind can exist independently of your brain and independently of your body, which is why we get rebirth, which is also why, according to ancient Buddhist cosmology, your mind transcends even the beginnings and the ends of this physical universe. You're not, I think it's Professor Epstein, with his intersecting membrane theory, replacing string theory. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because my science is not in depth anymore. I just get this from scientific journals who give summaries rather than the guts of the research. But Epstein, I think he's over in UCLA, was saying that his theory of intersecting membranes, replacing string theory, predicted not just one Big Bang, but a number of serial universes, one after the other. Basically, he was saying this is not the first Big Bang, it won't be the last. There's been many serial universes. But that begs the question, if that is so, where do, if you like, souls or streams of consciousness come from? Are they created at the Big Bang? And the Buddha says that they were independent of the physical universe. Because even in the ancient Buddhist texts, the Buddha was saying you could remember 91 eons, 90 Big Bangs, basically. Because the mind can be independent of the body, and can also be independent of form, things, universes, even though the universe ends, the mind will still carry on. A fascinating theory, and it can have some proof behind it. When you understand how powerful that mind is, sometimes you always remember this, the famous Schrodinger equation. You do need an observation, a mind, to collapse that equation and create reality as we know it. The science which I learned was over 30 years ago. You had to have a mind there, you had to have an observation. You have to have an observer to make life as we know it. It was as if the world was an interaction of mind and stuff. It's not that mind came out of stuff, but not that stuff came out of mind, but the world was an interaction of both. And that's what fascinates me, the interaction of our mind with the world. That interaction is what we call our life. I get frustrated sometimes when some people run the agenda trying to undermine science with some ideas like intelligent design. Intelligent design is easily disproved by just looking at the type of people who are propounding such ideas, who are certainly not intelligent. Who designed them? And the point of such complexity in this world of life is what creates that complexity. It's the desire. Who was it? This was actually after I became a monk. There was some guy who finally disproved the third law of thermodynamics, that entropy always increases. He got a Nobel Prize for it. Who was that guy? Do you remember? But actually his thesis was, if you have a closed system with life in it, basically with consciousness in it, then that can reverse that third law of thermodynamics and can give more organization. Now that's a great piece of science, where it showed that consciousness is the organizing principle of this universe. It decreases entropy. But what that really means is that when you add life to this stuff of the world, that organizing principle is what drives what we call evolution. There was an interesting piece of evidence which emerged some years ago in a coal mine in South Wales. Many of you are old enough to remember a British Prime Minister called Margaret Thatcher, who closed many coal mines in the UK because they were uneconomic, so she said. But many coal mines were closed. This particular coal mine was close to an urban area. It was fenced off, closed, but not filled in. In that suburban area, many people who had cats with kittens would try and give their kittens to their friends, but sometimes there were too many kittens, you didn't know what to do with them. Many of them took advantage of that disused coal mine and threw the kittens down the shaft. As a Buddhist, I think that's incredibly cruel, but that's not the point of what I'm saying. So many kittens were thrown down that hole in the ground, maybe, I don't know, 2 kilometers down or something. 99% of those kittens died, but a few survived. You know how agile cats are. A few survived, because about 10 years after the coal mine was closed, engineers went down there to check on the safety of the shafts. When they went down there, they made an incredible discovery. Those kittens who survived had mutated into a completely new species of cat. Blind, but with huge ears. Ears which you don't see in a normal cat. They had mutated into a new species simply because of the demands of their environment. In the darkness of the shafts of a coal mine, you don't need eyes. They became blind after a few generations. But you sure needed your ears. You had to enhance your hearing to ward off predators, to mate, to find food. So in a space of 10 years, and you can tell it was a short time, but they knew when that coal mine was closed down, and now they knew when this new species had appeared. Somewhere in that time, a new species had evolved. And it's very clear it was the craving and desire that motivated the evolution of a new species. This is how life organizes and changes and creates a complexity which empowers evolution, if you like. So please, may as scientists, you defend your territory against the encroachments of irrational thinkers who are just promoting the whole agenda, who want to change the facts to fit their faith, instead of the movement of true truth seekers to change your faith to fit the facts, which is science, which is what I call Buddhism. So as we do this, we can challenge such ideas and create a greater commitment to honesty and truth, not only in science, in our labs, in our workstations, but also in our life. When the world is committed to truth, when there is more honesty in this world, then there won't be such spin as you see in our governments. Spin has been going on a long time. I remember a story of a wealthy family in the US who wanted to write a history of their clan, and they employed a famous author to research their family and write a book on their history. They told him they wanted it to be accurate and truthful, no lies. Oops. To be no lies, but if there was anything embarrassing, please don't put it in the book. The author's problem was that there was one member of the family called Uncle George who'd been sent to the penitentiary for rape and had been executed in the electric chair. He was a black sheep of the family. How could he be honest but still not impugn the good name of the family? So this author, who was one of the originators of Spin, wrote in the book, in the later years, Uncle George got a chair in one of the famous US institutions, the chair of applied electricity. And his death came as a great shock. Which is being very dishonest, but you can't fault it, because that's actually what happened. Unfortunately, though, because of that lack of honesty, whether in science, whether in religion, whether in politics, creates huge numbers of problems in everybody's life. So when you have innovation, you stick to the truth, you investigate, always innovate, then you understand just how we can create progress in our field, whether it's field of religion. We're always innovating in Buddhism. That's why we have that website. The way I innovated in Australia was to ensure that our committee, the people who actually run the business of a monastery, were all young. Our president for the last 3 years is in his early 20s. Too often, presidents, the people who make the decisions, chancellors, vice chancellors and deans, are all old guys. That is one of the problems with universities, as it is with any organization. By insisting on young people being in key positions of the organizing body of my monastery, I got innovation. So we got a great website and all sorts of new things. I'd said to many people, we use a model which I first heard about in Malaysia. Get the young people to actually to run the organization. They're the ones with the ideas. The mature people, they supply the funds. Because then they got wealth. You know, they've been established in time. And that's the way we've been innovating. To be able to get, you know, Buddhism, if you like, has a mission in this world. Sure, people like the Dalai Lama said he's not out to convert people. That's just spin. Of course he's in the business of converting people. You're always in the business of spreading what you believe is helpful and truth. Even in science, you're into converting people to your ideas. But unfortunately, many people are scared of conversions. That's why we don't mention that word. But I'm being honest about it. In the early years of my monastery in Australia, when we just bought the land, all we had to protect our assets, such as building materials and building tools, was a wire fence. And I was asked to say, look, this is really dangerous. Anyone could just walk in here and steal things. So we thought of putting up a sign, trespassers will be prosecuted. Straight away, I realized such a sign would never work. So I put up a sign which said, trespassers will be converted. And that kept everybody out. It's a great sign to keep people out of a church or out of a temple. Because we're more afraid of conversion than anything else. But the point is that we should be open to conversion, to new ways of looking at things, new ideas. And that openness really should be what religion is all about, what science is all about. I've said to a person just as I came in here, of all people in this world, religious people should be the hardest to offend. We should be the most tolerant. For example, when? 3 or 4 months ago, I think it was, could be 6 months, when the US troops in Guantanamo Bay were accused of flushing a copy of the Quran down the toilet. The next day someone asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what would your response be if someone flushed a Buddhist holy book down the toilet? And straight away I said, I would call a plumber. I'm a very practical monk. But the point is, don't flush the principles of Buddhism or any religion down the toilet by flushing its holy book down the toilet. The whole principles of a religion is peace, harmony, love. So you don't flush that down the toilet. In the same way, never allow the principles of science to be flushed down any toilet. They can abuse your research. They can offend you by saying that everything you've done is wrong. But please never allow the principles of science, argument, investigation, truth and honesty, never allow that to get flushed down the toilet. In other words, you allow argument, discussion to happen as much as possible. And please be innovative. Religions are rebellious. Scientists should be the same, on the cutting edge, not to be just someone who just follows the old lines of thinking. One of the practices of meditation, mindfulness, is to do things in a different way. A practical explanation of that is when you get up in the morning, when you brush your teeth, what side of the mouth do you begin with? Do you always brush from the left to the right, from the top to the bottom? Or the other way around, whatever way it is, tomorrow morning start on the other side. You may think that's petty, but when you start doing things in a different way, when you train yourself to get out of your habits, doing things in a strange way, that's where you get innovation. You don't get innovation through repeating what everyone else has done. Called mindfulness, which is opening more doors, seeing wider. When you are conditioned, when you are trained, you just see things in one way, you're narrow-minded. With research in science, if you really want to find something new, do things new, please be completely rebellious. Do things in a different way, come to this university a different route if that's at all possible. Sit with your chair backwards. Whatever it is, put your computer upside down, I don't care what it is. But do things differently. You always find innovation. And that's the only way we find research. By being rebellious, innovative, even being stupid sometimes. In that stupidity, in that fun, in that play, that's where we discover things. That certainly is the way of Buddhist meditation. For those of you who meditate on the breath, for the last few years I've taught a new way of meditating on the breath, which I call backwards breath meditation. It's innovative. Backwards breath meditation. Have I said this here yet? Have you heard about backwards breath meditation? It's very easy but very powerful. When you watch the breath in meditation, you watch the breath going in, breath going out, breath going in, breath going out. Isn't that the case? Backwards breath meditation is when you watch the breath going out first, then the breath going in. Out, in, out, in. You try that. It may sound the same, but actually it's completely different. You're just being rebellious, looking things in a new way. And it works. So this is how we have innovation, rebelliousness. We make truth our most important thing. We argue. We don't allow ourselves to be attached to what we're investigating, so we don't hinder progress because of our reputation, because of our wanting of funding. because the truth is more important than any individual. So this, I think, is the way that science and real religion can go forward into this world. So, I've said enough so far. Hopefully, I've said enough things which offended you, so you can ask a question back. Any questions? Yes, straight away. Thank you, sir.
Actually, I truly appreciate your open ideas about facts, and that's the first time I hear it from a religious person. Thanks for interesting talk, yeah.
That's a shame.
I have two questions. First, I do meditations and I see wonderful effects. What does this prove?
What does it prove? That it shows you that you have a powerful mind. You see wonderful effects. If you have a powerful mind, now use it. Find out some of the great answers. So the answers to the great questions in life. Like one of the things I've been teaching in meditation for the past few years is when a person gets a strong mind, ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? I'm going to be very careful because I have monastic rules which prohibit me from saying all the things which I've discovered, and all the things which I can do. But when I first started doing this, what's my earliest memory? I got a smell in my nose, which I recollected straight away was the smell of my baby's pram. And straight away I was re-experiencing being a baby for the gap of about 30 or more years between who I was when I remembered this and my babyhood. You could visualize, you could see your pram there. And all of the toys which my mother had. You were literally back there in the past. Later on, when I told that experience to a doctor, he mentioned that in the first few weeks of your life, the dominant sense is your smell. You recognize your surroundings, you recognize your mother, not by what she looks like, because your sight is not developed enough yet. Of such recognition. Your whole world revolves around smell when you were infant. And I know that as a fact, so we experienced it. The next thing which you do, earlier, please. And most people get their life in their mother's womb. They know what it feels like. It's a strange type of memory, meditation based, but you reconnect with the life in the mum's womb. So you know if the fetus feels pain or consciousness or whatever, because you're right back there, literally.
But based on what you said about Francis Bacon, it's just an evidence. It does not prove that.
What it does disprove, if you get your life back in the womb, it does disprove the fact that the fetus is unconscious, doesn't feel pain.
And
then you get your past lives, which is the most important. You get a time in a different body at a different time. And that's powerful for you.
Thanks. And the second question I had to
say. Yeah?
And about that patient, about that person that was proved to be brain dead.
Yeah.
I strongly question that conclusion that you made, that you concluded that our brain is independent, our mind is independent of the brain.
Can be independent.
Yes, and based on that system that's connected to the brain and detects the signals, when it goes off, it does not show any brain death. It just shows that those certain signals are not transmitted anymore. I mean, here, this conclusion that we say, because those signals are not there anymore, this person is brain dead, is not correct. Am I right?
No. So I'm quoting from the article. Professor Pim van Lommel knows much more than me about medical science. He said that in such situations that people were clinically brain dead. That's what he said. So argue with the professor, not with me.
Okay. I just wanted to show that this is not a very clear conclusion.
I think it probably is, but yes.
Can I just add to that? I think I understand what you're saying, because I have the same thought.
Yeah.
That conclusion, all it actually says is that we can't detect whatever is there. there may be some other system that currently don't have the technology to detect that we're not seeing yet. So we're at a limit in terms of what we can measure.
You may be able to say that, but please read the article, because he dismisses many of those arguments in his argument about what was happening.
You can't dismiss something we haven't yet detected.
You can't dismiss something we've not yet detected, but you can dismiss the activity of the brain if there's not a brain there, if there's not a brain showing any activity, if you know the pathology of the brain at that particular stage. The reason why you're resisting this argument is because you come at the argument with a preconceived notion that the brain is important. Consciousness cannot survive the death of a brain because that has consequences which threaten your worldview. Now, sometimes that resistance, maybe you might not see it, but that resistance should be seen as the way that we look in one direction at life. Our worldview often restricts the way we can accept or not accept information. And this is actually why when we do research, when we do come across these pieces of information, why they do challenge us, and instead of trying just to sort of find some flaw in the argument, sometimes it's good to try to find a flaw in an argument, but we should also try to find out, is there resistance there and why? Remember that as most of the advances in science were resisted by the academic community almost tooth and nail before they would actually accept it. And the reason was because it challenged the heart of our worldview. I mean, take sort of the famous case of Einstein and Bohr, Niels Bohr, arguing so much. And you know, Einstein's famous saying that God doesn't play dice. Unfortunately, they do. That resistance to some of the facts is one of the points which I was trying to make here today.
It's not a correct comparison between the two, for example, the Einstein's theory with this brain death conclusion that you made. Because remember that many years ago when the person's heart stopped, people regarded that death, but you know that you have a certain amount of time to recover that, and it's no longer death. You know? So the same way, when those signals are off, it doesn't mean that the person is brain dead. There are still something that we don't know. So what I argument is that this conclusion that the person is brain dead is not correct, or logically is not correct. You don't have enough evidences to say that.
Okay.
Brain dead.
I think the conclusion you're making is missing the point. Is Professor Pim van Lommel, this is the clinical term for a person in that situation. He made that statement, not me. The point which we're missing here is that the consciousness was present at that particular state, whether you call it brain dead or not, the consciousness was existing there with no possibility that that was happening because of a brain.
Yes, and this is exactly the resistance.
Well, that's absolutely consistent with what you've all argued, because it clearly indicates that there is a mechanism which we don't quite yet understand.
Yeah.
So I don't see the inconsistency at all.
Good, okay, fair enough.
You are resisting with this.
Yeah. This is good. Come on.
Shouldn't Occam's razor be applied in this type of argument?
Good.
You're adding an unsupported hypothesis to support
Yes.
You're saying there is a mechanism. That's
no,
the hypothesis.
You're saying
that we can't detect it.
That's
all. There is a mechanism we can't detect.
There could be both.
Okay.
It's an unsupported hypothesis.
This is
for your general.
That's
the
hypothesis.
There is a mechanism. You don't know what
to carry in mind.
In the brain. In the brain.
Say so. Then
that's the argument. Where is it? In the brain.
When the doctor says someone is dead, we shouldn't be burying him more. In that case, because you can always then blame the technology. Say,
right.
Doctor
no,
said
but
you
but
are
but
dead.
I mean, you know, within acceptable parameters, I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, if the signal is not there,
I think it is prerogative of the person.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you want to define, if you want to redefine the term, then you may come up with a
different
term.
Yes,
modify it.
I guess as a scientist, it just comes down to, so we call them clinically dead. It's a definition. It's a definition. So we call them clinically dead, but then they wake up. Therefore, they were dead. So what's bridging the gap? And that's the question. As a scientist, I would want to know, what is that? So that's where we're saying, what is that thing?
So this is actually,
and it may be that we don't have the ability to detect it. And there's lots of other theories out there. Roger Penrose has some about consciousness and quantum theory. But right now, we don't have the tools to detect it. Same as, you know, 200 years ago, we couldn't detect electrical signals. We didn't have MRIs and things like that. It's a detection. That's all I look at it.
Yeah.
Just to keep the mind open. Well, maybe there's something that we can get to sort of find out.
Yes, or maybe it is like consciousness surviving death, a mind existing independently.
Sure. Yeah, but I don't want to know
what
the mechanism is.
Yeah.
Well, the mechanism is that the nature of the mind. But to do that experiment, that's why I say that any science should be repeatable. Anyone should be able to do the same standard procedures and be able to repeat the effects. However, that's personal. You actually do need to find someone who's dying. And if you want to do that through your meditation, you have to actually do it your personal, do the meditation yourself. But you can stop the brain and see what the mind is doing. Or, for example, what I was saying about recording past lives. Past life research, was, many of you may know, was done by a scientist called Professor Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia. His particular story was, he was a GP, very brilliant man, and after working in the general community for a while, he was given a professorship teaching medicine at University of Virginia. He branched out to psychiatry and then became a professor of psychiatry. He was still looking for new areas to research, and he decided to research people who could spontaneously remember their past lives. He did a huge amount of research on that. The ironic part of his research, he got his funding from the Xerox Corporation. People who reproduce bits of paper were paying for to see if he could reproduce a life. Huge amounts of research done on that, but no one is interested. Would it be interesting to find out if you lived before? If you could remember your past life, how can you remember that? What's the mechanism?
The question really then becomes whether mind, which may perpetuate itself beyond this side of the body, requires mechanism as defined in any kind of physical thing, whether it's the brain or something else. Does it require such a mechanism, or is it just the nature of the world? And if so, does that itself constitute a mechanism? And then, does that matter?
Yeah. Basically, the mechanism of the mind is run on desire. This is something which fuels the mind. Desire does not live in your body, but lives in a mind. So this is a mechanism which feeds the mind and keeps it going. It fuels it. However, that is something which is hard for to measure physically. Maybe it's because we have the wrong instruments. Maybe because the instruments which we use are physical instruments. And again, sometimes you look at quantum theory, you can never measure anything. You know, you know what it was. So what are you measuring anyway with your instruments? Sometimes the mind is actually before measuring. So what does the measuring? How can you measure the measurer? Sorry? It's great actually to start doing these sorts of ideas. Because I like to confound science sometimes. And not to confound it, but to confound all the ways of thinking of things so we can extend our repertoire. Yeah?
There's been rapid advancements in artificial intelligence and computer science, robotics. I'm wondering, from the Buddhist perspective, is there potentiality for the right causes to be put in place for a mind through rebirth to attach, to create, I suppose, a new sentient being?
Yeah, I would think so. I think a mind could take rebirth into a very advanced computer system. And I know that was actually, I don't know if you know, what a, maybe not old enough, Fred Hoyle wrote a book called The Andromeda something.
Strange.
Yeah. Yes. But that's actually what that happened. A computer which had an intelligence. Or like in 2001, HAL. A computer with attitude.
And I guess part B to that question is, what does Buddhism say about the origin of humanity or the human species?
The origin of humanity. In Buddhism, the humanity is not that different from any other animal species. For any of you who know that Linnaeus, he was the guy who started this species business. He categorized all living beings at the time into species. He had his methodology, which he obviously is a good scientist, he worked out the methodology before he applied it. And he tried to apply it indiscriminately. So he could categorize, because of his method, which being belonged in which category. When he came to the categories of human beings, Homo sapiens, chimpanzees and the gorillas, they all fat into the same species. However, because of the religious situation of his time, he realized his research would not be accepted if he put primates into the same category as Homo sapiens. That was the one time he regretted it, but he had to do it. He stopped his methodology and split the species. Whereas, according to his methodology, we are the same species. The difference between human beings and animals is not that great. One of the histories of the advancements of our cultures is many years ago, we were racist. If you're a white man, you were supposed to be superior than the black man. That was transcended how many years ago in most cultures. However, for the last 20 or 30 years, we had to transcend the gender gap, where males were considered to be superior than the females. We pretty much transcended that, not fully. Now the next gap we have to transcend is the species gap. The feeling that a human being who is so damn superior than our animals, that we'd eat them, experiment on them, when the evidence shows there's hardly much difference at all.
Can you elaborate on something? In the discussion on near-death experience and what death is, the whole discussion has been involved with physicality.
Yes.
Does physicality define the existence of life?
Yeah.
Now, this university, I don't know if it still does, but it used to have a paranormal psychology department. You go interdisciplinary, they're talking about different stuff. When you start talking paranormal, they're talking like psychic powers and stuff.
Yeah.
And they may enter a totally different realm. So, in regard to what the lady in the red shirt said, it's something you can't measure. It may not be something you can physically measure. It may be totally another dimension, maybe another form. You can use like energy, which is like something physically measured. But you can say even the word power is indicates something physical. And maybe another form that we haven't really defined to elaborate on what you say. So we don't know. But what I want to say is we've always used physicality to define existence. Physicality may not, like the experience you talked about, the experience may not be physically related.
Correct. So that's what we should do. We should expand our ideas of measurement. Anyway, we only measure effects. We never measure the thing itself. So maybe we can find the effect of a mind on paranormal things. But never think we could actually measure the thing in itself. That's how we define anything in this world, by its effect. Very often by its relationships with other particles. Relationship in situations such as fields. But how do we know the thing in itself, what it is? You only know how it behaves. Can you really know as you accept as a daily part of your discipline? So we should equalize, give equity to the standard of proof.
Yeah? I've always thought of Buddhism as something that was relatively consistent with science.
Yeah.
So easiest to relate to two of them. However, recently I read someone make quite the opposite claim that actually Buddhism, in its essence, was contrary, not opposed to science, finally. And it had a great deal to do with perceptions of what reality is and the sense that there is actually something to measure, that there is actually something as a fact, and that since these are all simply figments of a mind illusioned, really science is itself delusion, and Buddhism knows better. Is that one person's opinion and not well reflected, or is there some substance to that?
Most there is no substance to that, but the scientific method is the one which I really liked and kept. But with observation, which you very know that very often is a skewing of the data, very often when you do any research, you always find anomalies, things which don't fit the curve. And those are the ones which too often that people just file away or they rub out, they delete.
I worked in nonlinear physics for a period, and it was fairly clearly understood anecdotally that at the turn of the century, anything that was nonlinear was considered uninteresting,
yeah.
Or could at least be approximated as linear. Nonlinear wasn't mathematically tractable, so why would we want to bother with that?
Yeah.
Of course, an awful lot popularized in the form of chaos theory and other nonlinear behaviors has shifted the attention. So now all of a sudden, nonlinear is, it's the most popular thing around. Yeah. Linear is old and boring and only taught in the first year.
Yeah.
But it was certainly a change of mindset that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Change of mindset means that even religions have to keep growing. Any religion which relies on old dogma is dead religion. Same with science.
Well, isn't that a religion of sorts? There's a certain number of underlying axioms which have to be accepted as true and cannot be proved or disproved in order to do the investigation.
Well, you've got to challenge the axioms. That's most important. Every axiom, even what I've just said today, I take on board what you say, I challenge these things. I have to keep challenging them.
That itself is an axiom.
Sorry, it is.
So we're to focus on the blips, are we? Because that's an interesting thing.
A whole lot, yeah. The blips are where the action is sometimes. When things go wrong. When things are not the way they're supposed to be. That's what's interesting. That's a disproof of Bacon.
Well, the difference between Einsteinian gravitation and Hawking gravitation is really on the blips. Newton had most of the basics covered. Why didn't he bother to prove it? It's all in singularities and extreme cases. Science depends on anything.
So in those extreme cases, you get the most interesting information. Like that guy who just did meditation. He went to the hospital. Like other people have done the same.
The extreme case of Buddhism would be the fact that everything arises and ceases is itself something which will change in the end?
Right, when everything ceases.
Sorry?
When everything ceases, that's the extreme case. When nothing is left. That's extreme. That's the extreme emptiness of Buddhism. The only thing which can't change is nothing. I'm not trying to be clever here, but just like absolute emptiness of everything.
Sorry.
When you stop. Look, for example, that in the deep meditations, there's something which stops, which is your will, your choice. So in the deep meditation, you're frozen, fully conscious, you can't move. Where the potential to do, the choice, vanishes. There's an old analogy of the tadpole born in the water, grown up in the water, can never know what water is. When it leaves the water, then it has something to compare, it can know what water is. In the same way, can you really know what choice, what will is? And it's always been there for you.
potential. But when the potential to do, to choose, to be in charge, is taken away from you, you're still fully conscious. And that's new data, which gives you a different way of looking at things. The emptiness of the will. Yeah?
And you mentioned the jhana.
Yeah.
You're into a deep jhana.
Yeah.
What's still great and long. Even though you only get not much meditation of like long, it's like 5 minutes at a time. So it means that the state are sometimes available to intelligent practitioners, people who long, like you and long from dozens of years. So is there something that one can do to improve the chance of falling spontaneously
in general? Sure. It's very easy. Meditation, you don't hold the mind still. You try and hold it still, it will never be still. This is how many people meditate. They control the mind. If you control it, it will never be still. If you put it down, it becomes still by itself. So just let go, put it down, make peace, no controlling. No measuring. It's another method of meditation which I got from my science. Lord Kelvin not only gave his name to absolute temperature scale, but also was a philosopher of science, a founder of technology, who once stated, if we cannot measure accurately, we cannot control the world. It's obvious, part of technology. You measure first, and then you can actually control things. The opposite also works. If you don't measure, you don't control. So in a meditation, you don't measure. No good, no bad, no back, no forward. No time, no past. You stop measuring in your meditation, then you can't control, and the mind stops. In the ancient Sanskrit word, the word for mind is mano. What the mind does, mana, is to measure. In the ancient Sanskrit, the two words, from mana, that's where we get mind from. And what the mind does is to measure.